Hey there, hi there, ho there, everybody. How are you? Welcome back to another episode of the Kindness Warriors podcast. This episode is a special edition of the Creative Commons series of conversations that I am so excited to bring to you in 2024. We are going to be talking to some of the most creative, innovative, and inspirational people on the planet. I cannot wait to share these conversations with you. So let's crack into it. Kindness Warriors, let's go.
I want to get married in Vegas to a stranger on the strip, skinny dip in the ocean. Look, I don't give a rip.
Hey there, hi there, ho there, everybody. Guess what we're back with today? You got it? Another Kindness Warriors Creative Commons episode. And you know how I get about these things. You know how wildly excited I get about being able to share the wisdom of some of the wisest and most amazing creative minds on the planet. Today, my friend Emily Scott Robinson, recording artist, poet, deep thinker, deep feeler, biggest, most beautiful, gorgeous laugh on the planet, all of the things, she's here to drop some major wisdom bombs on all of us and to prove that razzle dazzle really has a place in life, especially if you are walking razzle dazzle. Emily is one of the kindest, most open hearts I have met in a long, long time. This conversation is one that really filled my heart and soul. And I hope while it fills your ears, it also fills your heart and soul with the kind of shaky, lovely, creative, beautiful, fizzy energy that we all need in our days. Whether you are a recording artist or a creative professional, or you are an accountant, or you work in project management, or you're a stay-at-home parent, whatever you do, you are a creative soul. And I hope you enjoy the next wee while that we spend together. As always, thank you for joining us. Here is my friend, the amazing Emily Scott Robinson.
Okay, check, check, check.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm at home in my house. It's so good to see you.
I haven't seen you in forever.
I know. I know. Like, I think it was Americana Fest 2022.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the last time I physically seen you. Wait. No, I think that might have been it.
Mm-hmm. That was it. That was the basis of our friendship love.
Yes, exactly. I'm good. I'm home. I'm in my little office. I've got my like weird witchy stuff and my books behind me and my electric guitar, which I don't play enough. And I'm home. I just got home from a run of a couple shows up in the Northeast. And I was playing in Northampton, Newburyport, and Portland, Maine. I just got back to another snowy place, back to Colorado.
Oh my goodness. And it is like, I've got a sweater on, but it's like 75 degrees here today.
Oh my God. That is amazing.
It's weird. It's like, I'm a big like grandpa now. I love sweaters. And so I'm like 75 again. Gosh.
I know. I argue about like the temperature in our house with my partner because he wants to like, he wants it to be warm enough to like be in like underwear and a t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And I love the feel of just being in something giant and cozy. Like, this is like my winter sweatshirt. And last night he was like, it's kind of cold in here. And I was like, yeah, well, you're wearing no clothes. And then I was like, I have become my father. I've become my father. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I love big cozy things. But yeah, that's, you live in an environment where it's hard to wear big cozy things.
I do. But I also like in New Zealand, the houses there are not renowned for their heat holding abilities at any time. So I did like 20 years of being in like full 4 or 5 layers in my house.
Oh my God.
It's funny what you miss and how the grass is sometimes greener and all of those things. Because
totally.
I mean, 75 and sunny in Southern California is not a bad thing, is it?
I know, the hegemony of beautiful weather. The hegemony of the sun. How are you doing? How long now has it been since you moved?
Oh my goodness. Almost 9 months, I think.
Wow.
I could have cooked a baby in that time.
I know. That's a long time. Mm-hmm. It probably feels like a long time, and it's also not that long.
It feels like a long time. It feels like a short time because from the second I landed, I keep telling everybody I've slowed down to a stop. And it's like, wait a minute. I've been to Australia twice, New Zealand twice, New York, Nashville twice, Chicago. Okay, no, I haven't stopped.
Listen, our idea of slowing down is not slow. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's funny because I spent out of the past 5 weeks, I was gone for almost four of them. And it didn't occur to me. I got home and I was so exhausted. And I was like, I don't know why I'm so tired. What could it be? And it was like, bitch, you have been on the road nonstop. What is, it's nice to get home and to be in some rhythms, but we're the traveling kind.
That's it. Well, I think even like the basis of me finding you and finding like a sister soul was that not only did we have the traveling heart and the witchy stuff that's going on, but you are super amazing at vulnerability. And I don't know if that's something that comes part and parcel with your artistry or if it's something you've always been, but the thing that about you that always sticks out for me is just how open you've been with you and healing and strength and all of those things. So I know I didn't answer your question when you said,
that's
how
okay.
are you? Because I could say the word oof and you probably understand the depth of oof. Oh,
I feel the oof. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read your – I love getting your Substack, and I read your Substack today about the linoleum floors, like supporting us when we need to cry. And I was like, oh, and I need to send you my new song. It'll be on the next record, but I just want to send it to you. And I realize that if we don't edit this out, I'm just making a bunch of podcaster listeners jealous that I'm going to send you this song and nobody else can hear it. I've been performing
a little bit FOMO, guys.
I've been reckoning with how to write after my divorce and what on earth to say. And also like what on earth to say that is meaningful and an important use of my voice in this changing world and in me changing, right? Because like the world is changing, but we're all changing. And I think, you know, during COVID, I moved really from like, I moved into my middle age during COVID and through my divorce. And on the other side of that, I'm like entering the back half of my 30s. And when I started in the music industry, I was like, yeah, the currency of being like a young woman with ingenue energy is a currency you can really trade with in the business. And now I'm like, oh, who am I on the other side of this? And what on earth do I want to use my humble platform for the people who listen? Like, and what to say. And I had this – I have started so many songs in the past couple years, Cassie, and very few of them have made it across the finish line. But the one of them that I have finished is sort of like a blessing to all of the – like all of the sort of gritty hard work of growing up, of like raising children. You know this because you're a mom. And I'm not a mom, but my partner has a son and he lives with us part time. And almost all of my friends have become moms in the past 8 years. And then like just blessing, like it's called Bless It All. And it's like bless the starting over, bless the swallowing your pride, like bless all of these moments, like bless the desperation and the fear, like and
bless this linoleum floor. Let me
bless
tell
this linoleum floor. Exactly. So I feel like, though, you know, those things are really sacred, and it's one reason why I love reading what you share, because you remind me of what's sacred in the everyday. And like walking outside and seeing the sunshine and just breathing and being present with what is. So oof is an understandable descriptor.
Well, it's an interesting, like you say, this part of life, this moving into what next chapters are. And I love how you said the ingenue energy of youth, because I see that in my almost 18-year-old right now.
Yeah.
Last night we went to a concert that she bought tickets to, and she was like, I don't know who these people are. I think they're like punk emo. They were. it was the loudest, most fraught energy in a room that I felt in so long. But I'm watching this 17-year-old navigate a room of people 17 to 25 mostly. And then me, my best friend Laura, and her husband Ed are there as like the big chaperone energy. And there was a moment where Chelsea whispered to me, Mom, they're gonna like really go hard right now. Should we jump? And my brain went, fuck yeah, we're going to jump. And my friend caught it on camera, and you could see it. And I lost the moment of thinking, you're a middle-aged mom right now. It was just an 18-year-old saying, are we going to jump? And it was like, yes, we are going to jump. Not to say I almost didn't pee my pants, because when you give birth to a 10-pound child, even 18 years later, jumping isn't very smart out in public.
10 pounds. Oh my God.
There's a reason I only did it once.
Yes. That makes total sense. That's enough for everybody. That's, oh my God. That's amazing. I want that on a t-shirt. Like, not the 10 pound baby thing.
Baby.
But it's time to jump. Let's jump.
Yeah.
What was it exactly? What was the phrase that she said?
She said, Mom, are we going to jump?
Are we going to jump? I love that.
It was like, of course we're going to jump, baby. Yeah. Yes. But it's looking at those moments of, she's got her whole life ahead of her, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And I feel like as a parent, I've prepared her for that. But what I haven't prepared myself for, because I didn't know as a woman that this was something I had to do, was I had to prepare myself for when she flies, for when she jumps. And it's like, whoa, man. Whoa. This is going to be wild. This is going to be wild to be, you know, you and I think, went through our divorces at similar times.
I think we did.
And this is my round two on divorce. So, you know,
listen, they just say it gets easier, right, Kathy? we're just dangerous women.
Let me tell you.
You don't want to fall in love with us. Once the dam breaks. No, I'm just kidding.
fall in love with a woman who reads, who writes, who cries making love, whatever that quote is. I'm like, oh my God, yes. Oh my God. At your own risk.
I mean, it's so funny. I think. Well, I mean, you've had several great loves in your life, including your daughter and yourself.
Absolutely.
And so have I. I'm a little bit younger, so I was married once before this. But I just think that having multiple partners over the course of a lifetime is something that when we break it out of the stiffness of like patriarchal Christianity and power structures that benefit from from marriage. When we break it out of that and we just look at it on its head, of course it makes sense to fall in love with one person and walk through motherhood and parenting with them, and then to find yourself completely and utterly changed on the other side, or a deeper version of yourself looking for new and different things in life and no longer well matched with that partner. And it's really interesting because I think when you fall in love, you just now at this age, I just think, well, I'm here for as long as this makes sense for both of us. Yes. And yeah.
I love the idea of and I'm amazed. So I actually dated somebody last year and she said something to me really fascinating. She said, this is the second half. She's like, the first half of our game, we were learning, we were understanding how we moved on the court, where we played in a team. This is our second half.
Yeah.
Now we know the rules better. We know how to score. We know how to like do, you know, shoot a free throw, all of the things. And like how beautiful to have a second half and to find players who are going to make that team your all-star team. And it's not going to be a one player. It's going to be many. And I was just like, oof.
Oof. Oof. Oof. Exactly. Well, and how much we keep learning.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
how much we keep learning. And I mean, I have watched many adults that I know in my parents' generation and older keep marriages together, often at great expense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you start to remove the barriers, when you start to empower particularly women mm-hmm. who've traditionally sort of been trapped in marriage structures, when you start to remove the barriers and the obstacles and even like the negativity and the shame around divorce, you recognize that like it's a wonderful thing to fall in love multiple times in your life, to keep growing, and even to like set a partner free from being kind of stuck with you when you've played that first half with them and you're like, I think that actually there's something better in store for both of us ahead.
Yeah.
That's more right for both of us. Yeah. not everybody gets to have that experience when they get a divorce. Like, that's a nice way to package it. I feel really lucky because my ex-husband and I, you know, got to the point where we were like, hey, thank you. This was an amazing adventure. I regret nothing and I love you and it's been great and you will always be family to me.
Yes. Yes. I think the idea of staying as the most important part of a relationship doesn't hold water for me anymore. The idea of attachment doesn't hold water for me anymore. The idea of like flow and moving does. It's fascinating. Yeah. I went on boy, this is going to be a real revelation. I went on a Disney cruise last week.
Amazing.
So first ever cruise. Not only just like first ever cruising experience.
Oh, wow. You went all in.
Mm-hmm. And my best friend. It was Disney, but my best friend's husband got me a few whiskeys deep and was like, look, I will do anything for you to take my spot because I need you to. And I love him dearly. So I was like, I can't think of anything better. Like 5 days with my best friend and no children. So she and I were together, but her brother and his kids were there. So we had children. So we got to see the suspension of disbelief, right?
Yeah.
And his wife is a super Disney fan. And then her parents were there. So I just really hijacked somebody else's family vacation. It was great. But it was a fascinating thing to watch. I think also as somebody who's lived outside of the United States for 20 years, to come back into the heart of the Disneyfication of love, of how what we should do as little girls and little boys. Not lots of mentions of, you know, gender diverse people at all, how girls should always find the prince. I know Disney's evolving their storyline a bit, but everything is just based in and around almost losing ourselves so that other people feel a little bit more comfortable. I mean, Frozen, wow, that is just avoidant attachment style. I was so triggered.
Completely.
Watching it again, I was like, oh my God, no, she's pushing her away. That's avoidance. No, let her
You're like, I did not get give Frozen, the writers of this movie, permission to talk to my therapist.
No. Literally, go build a damn snowman with your sister.
Like, yeah, it's really interesting. I think about the power of storytelling in this, right? Because we grew up with these stories and they are so strong. Mm-hmm. And like what is it about these stories that fills a need in us as a society? Or like, like, I just think about the power of those stories and how when we think we've failed at those stories, the kind of shame and loneliness and isolation and self-judgment that comes. I mean, even judgment that comes from others, right? Because like, I'm sure in your experience of divorce, like, you probably had some friends you lost. I did.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Definitely. And it was a little bit like, maybe this was just me projecting, you know, my own feelings of insecurity or judgment onto the silences of others. But a little bit of like, what kind of woman leaves something that's good enough?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who do you think you are? Like, or, I don't know, like a bit of just shame around desire and wanting something different in my life. And
And it's also, there's an unpacking, I guess, that comes with that too, when you talk about, you know, what we think hides in the silence. Of others. There's, for me, there's been a lot of unpacking this time around specifically, because I tried to do everything I could to leave as kindly as possible. Couldn't have done anything differently. Wouldn't have done anything differently. It's not a stretch to say I have not a single regret. But the ways in which society and friends and people think they should judge our relationships, and I hold a different kind of learning and growth from that now, even when I interact with other friends going through similar things around non-judgment and knowing that the only two people that know what went on in any relationship are the two people who are in it.
That, that till the end of time.
So how did you decide then what to write for new music? Because that is going to be vulnerable AF.
Pardon me. I was in Texas 2 weeks ago and my allergies are still calming down.
I thought you were going to say I smoked all the cigarettes.
I smoked a bunch of cigarettes before this. You know what? The real answer to that is I'm still figuring it out. I'm still figuring out what to write. I feel, and this is like a little bit scary to say, but it's taking me a long time to write after this. I think there are some songs that I've written and that need to still be finished that may never be shared with the world, that are just part of my own processing. And I'm getting absolutely no pressure from anyone on my team or anyone in the industry to write and release anything before I'm ready. But my own sense of internal pressure and wanting to be like good is looking back and going, okay, my last full length LP was in 2021. Like,
wow,
hurry up, girl. It was then. Isn't that wild?
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was the end of 2021. So there's part of me that's like, all right, girl, like, hurry up. And then I'm seeing that this year is flush with releases from Beyonce. And I'm like, great, good. I'm not releasing anything in 2025. This is Beyonce's year. That's great. It's not that I even compete with Beyonce for press, but I'm just like, perfect. Because I just want to listen to Beyonce's Cowboy Carter and write my own songs and then worry about releasing something next year. But I'm still in this, my overall feeling is one of quiet and one of reflection and listening. And it just feels like, and maybe it feels this way because we're all sort of online and also reading the news all the time, but it feels like we're at a fever pitch with voices in the room.
Ooh, that's a great way to put it.
You know what I mean? And I don't want to yell to be heard. I sort of want to draw people in with reflection and quiet and centeredness. And that's where it feels like the songs have really started to come from, that place. They won't even necessarily feel they don't feel really different from the things I've written before, like structurally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like this will be avant-garde or jazz or something different. Like when I write and release a new album, like it will still feel to my fans like
it's not just going to be ESR doing her. Flute.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to be what is that Andre 3000 who released the flute record? So amazing. Yeah. The goal is to get to that level where you're like, fuck this, I'm just going to do a flute album.
Yeah, and how brilliant. Like, how brilliant.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's incredible just to be like, I'm following the creative, I'm just following this creative thing, wherever it takes me. Yeah. So I think overall, it's like I'm writing about love and loss and heartbreak and grief and new life all crashing up together. Wow. Like you know when like the waves go out, but then also they're coming in?
Uh-huh.
Because you live in San Diego. So, or wait, do you live in – no, you live – yeah, you live in San Diego. Okay. Yeah. The greater San Diego area. But it I feel like that's really what I'm trying to capture is the realness, like the real experience of being human and to convey that. And I know that I'm on the right track because I regularly get messages from people who say to me, these are the things that have happened in my life, and this song of yours helped me walk through that. And it's always the songs that are about the stuff that is so hard for us to say, to admit to, right? Like wanting to leave a marriage that looks good on the surface. Mm-hmm. Songs about desire, songs about transgression, songs about pain and shattering. Like it's always these songs that people say to me, oh, that song, this helped me. And so I know that I'm on the right track. And the only thing I'm trying not to spill over too much into is like being a therapist in song, because I don't like that either. I want it to be like, I believe in storytelling and detail and the physical experience of a character or listening to a song. I believe that to be sort of the best for me, like creative portal in which people into a song and feel that truth, right? The show don't tell. And so there's a lot of things I want to say. There's a lot of editorializing I have about my own couple years and like aging and women and the world that we live in. But I want to – I'm working to not editorialize it too much but just tell and show, you know. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you were saying that, I was thinking about actually so my friend Vanessa plays with Brandi Clark. And I remember when Brandi dropped her album last year?
I think it was last year.
Because I was still in New Zealand. And I remember the day that it dropped, sneaking out to the balcony before dawn and I could hear the ocean and listening to this album and going, holy fuck. Because when you talk about the show don't tell and the storytelling, most of the stuff she talked about in her songs, I have not lived. You know, so I'm specifically thinking about the song she sings about her grandma and smoking in the house. Neither of my grandmas smoked. None of that. But that was it. I was right in there. I was grieving my grandmother again. I was feeling joy. And I was like, that is a storyteller's storyteller. And I feel like that's what you do with your music as well. I feel like that's it's not editorialized. It's narrative. Yeah. And it allows us to jump into that. The Disneyfication piece of the suspension of disbelief as humans who are healing.
Right. Completely.
Who do you look up to and who did you look up to when you were younger from a songwriting perspective?
Definitely. Well, first of all, Brandi Clark is like one of the greatest. and when you mentioned her album, I was like, oh yeah, this is like a gold standard example.
Like the start to finish of that thing was just.
Oh yeah. Of that kind of songwriting and storytelling and the power of that and the craft of that, right? Because I have so much respect for the craft too. Like Brandi's been doing it at least twice as long as me. But so much respect for the, because when you, when you're able as a writer to really, really like hone and be so specific about your choices and to carve and sculpt over time such that the songs can breathe and the stories can breathe, that's, that sort of power and spaciousness together is just something that like a lot of people don't even know exists.
Right.
And when something hits you that powerfully, you're like, oh, wow, that hit me that powerfully. But maybe you don't, I mean, not you, but maybe people don't always even know the level of intention and craft that went into that experience to give you, the listener, the space to connect to your own grandmother. And some of the writers I looked up to the most were, I listened to Patty Griffin pretty much exclusively and nonstop through my early 20s. And especially her earliest records all through like the 90s and early 2000s are just they're just ridiculous. They're so,
that's some truth telling. That is some,
that's some truth telling. And oof. Oh man. And then of course there are other songwriters I really looked up to. I mean, I love Brandi Carlile. I love, yes, love Brandy. I loved John Prine and Dolly Parton and Emmy Lou and Loretta and kind of a lot of those. But, you know, Nancy Griffith was one of my big influences kind of earlier on, especially in the like, in the like storytelling country vein. She's got such a, and she's passed away, but she had such a amazing, like, just thick as hell Texas accent and this like twangy nasal way of singing that I think sometimes people now would maybe like skip a song right away, because it's like there's some on the nose 90s country percussion, there's a little synth, and there's some like you know, like it feels like it's very much like a timestamp of when it was produced, but if people could just listen to her writing and her storytelling, oh my god. And so I grew up listening to her, Mary Chapin Carpenter, of course.
Every time I listen to Mary Chapin Carpenter and post something about it, my friends will be like, are you okay? Because they know I don't think. They will, like, I have three or four That's friends amazing. Who will literally all text and be like, we saw you tweeted about Mary. Are you fine? What's going on?
That's like your cry for help. That's amazing. Stones that is in the so road, funny. Guys. Oh my god. Stones in the road. Stones in the road. And I just, I, God, and well, and then, you know, in like the, in another world that wasn't country, like Ani DiFranco. I mean, I was from 14 to 16, Ani was like almost the only person I listened to.
this makes sense. This stacks up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And now, the record I listened to the most in the past 2 years is Anais Mitchell's last solo album. And it was so fucking brilliant. And I could talk for hours about why it's so brilliant. But I just, there was also this sense of like, she's also reckoning with like aging and motherhood and a changing world and like death and quiet in these ways that I feel like I listened and I was like, this is a revelatory album to me. the songwriting on it. Oh, and Jason Isbell. his songwriting is just so, it's so good. His newest album is so good. And I like, when Death Wish came out, I was like, I just listened to that song nonstop. I don't know if you've listened to it. It's so, so, so good.
I have not yet. It's strange. I had two friends who opened for Jason in Nashville. So I was there. I saw him twice and was like, you know, wandering around like a little ghost at the Ryman. And I was like, I must make sure that I come back and listen to this man because the crowd that he drew.
Oh, my God.
The diversity of the crowd, the feeling of the room. Oh, my.
Yeah.
You know when you walk into a room and there's just a certain time on a certain night? He does that apparently every night.
Oh, yeah. That makes total sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and talk about, you know, vulnerability. Like when Jason got sober and wrote Southeastern, and it was like more of an acoustic album than anything he had done before. That was like what, you know, built this fan base now. That, you know, that was something that like – that was such a pivotal moment in his career. And that kind of vulnerability is incredibly powerful.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, his new album is so good. I love it so much. I want to open for Jason.
Oh, vulnerability too, when you talk about the things that we go through, the big hard things that we're often told to not talk about, you know, to put underneath the surface. I find especially in today's day and age, there's such a conundrum with quote-unquote country music radio, sometimes even Americana, where there's this thought that somebody has to be a certain way. You have to be a certain kind of person to be successful, to have a community, to grow your fan base. And I feel like that's completely the wrong answer, that most of the people who are starting to really grow, to take off, are the people who are leaning into their truth and their vulnerability, who are allowing the cracks to show and showing everybody else, like, this is normal. This is human experience.
Yeah. I mean, completely. Because that's how you gain true fans. And I don't mean this to say that there's not something really cool about like a polished performance. That's cool. That's interesting. But your polished performance, and I'm not speaking to anybody specifically, but your polished performance is the least interesting thing about you.
Correct.
And I remember, so like early on when I was first kind of learning to perform, I took a workshop with Amy Spies, who is an amazing songwriter in Nashville. And she's also a really fantastic teacher. And she had a bunch of experience in theater. And she'll basically teach these performance workshops for a couple days at Song School, which is in Lyons, Colorado, every summer. And she really instilled in me this sense. And I was also like, I was the right person to hear this and believe it and put it in action. Or one, this was already kind of in the vein of what I was feeling like music was about for me. But she was like, an audience can tell if you're walking on stage and you're trying to get from them. And you're like, you know, you're trying to take, like you want them to give to you. The real revolutionary thing is to walk out on stage and to see the audience. The audience wants to be seen by you.
Yes.
This is a customer service job, she said.
Yes.
Like, this is about connection. This is about authenticity. This is where you take the mask off. That's the most powerful thing you can do. Ooh. And I started doing that, and it's been the best like performance. I mean, I don't want to call it a trick because it's not trick, but like it's been the guiding principle of performance and music for me, which is it's about being actually human on stage. And I this happened to me this weekend. I was on, I wouldn't normally do this, but I would have canceled these shows, but I'd planned them for months and I didn't want to cancel them. And I was like still relatively okay to travel, but I had a sinus infection left over from being at South by Southwest. My doctor prescribed me prednisone to help reduce the inflammation. I was having some like bronchitis symptoms. So I was on prednisone for these shows and my brain just like went blank twice a night. And I completely forgot the lyrics to some of my songs to the point where I was vamping on stage, asking an audience member to Google them and prompt me. And the funniest thing is that the audience fucking loved it.
Because it's real.
They were like, it's real. They were like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is the best thing ever. And I was like, I'm really glad that you enjoyed this. It was even like a little looser than I would have wanted it to be professionally, because I do want to perform well. I want to be professional. But I would say to the audience, a couple songs in, I was like, listen, just so you know, I'm on a bunch of medications right now.
Yeah, I'm on the drugs.
I'm a little loopy. So here we are. We're all in this together. But that which is human about us is the most powerful thing that we can share. I just like, I see that play out all the time. And yeah. It's beautiful. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so awesome. And like, that's my strategy.
Connection. It's genuine connection. I see you, you see me. So that was also a moment. Like when you do things like just say, hey, look, I'm a human. I wanted to be here tonight. You might have to Google my lyrics. that feels like you're saying to people, like, I trust you enough to hold this imperfection and to see me and to still love what we're doing together. Similar thing happened with, again, Vanessa and Psy, the Tattletale Saints, when they were playing in Auckland. And Psy has this amazing song where he just rips it up on the harmonica.
Oh my God.
He's such a nerd. He's got like 9 different harmonicas and he's seriously love that man. And he, for some reason, he blanked. He blanked in this song. And I had it all lined up. I think it was Dancing Under the Dogwoods on my Spotify. And he loved it. He's like, I can't. I'm like, I got you, bro. And all the Kiwis were like, ah. And that was one of those moments where as a performer, he would be like, ah, but everybody loved it. Everybody loved it because it was imperfection at play and real.
Exactly. Oh my God. I love, you know, Psy was the first guitarist I ever played with in Nashville.
No.
He accompanied me on my very first Americana Fest showcase.
Really?
Somebody like recommended him to me and I contacted him and reached out and he played with me. And I kid you not, this was the second time I had ever played with a full band. Ever.
Wow.
I was so nervous and Psy was so wonderful. And at some point somebody introduced like the band or like introduced all of us, or maybe I said his name and somebody repeated it. Maybe I'm making this up and it happened at a different show, but at some point somebody on stage referred to him as Sidewind Stanley instead of Sywin Stanley. And I was like, this is your alter ego, Sidewind Stanley. It was amazing. But so whenever I think of Sy, I think of Sidewind Stanley, but he's such a wonderful artist, like, because he's so present and he's so creative and open and you could feel that on stage. You can really feel that when somebody is giving that to you as a part of your band.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so
his artistry and his craft is what drives him and his values. And I love people who are that passionate about the thing that they do, the thing that they put into the world.
But
he is also no ego. He's funny and he stayed with me when the Tattletale Saints were playing New Zealand this time last year. And I can remember one day I was in the kitchen cooking dinner and I could hear Vanessa chit-chatting. And then it was like silent. There wasn't any side chatter. And I was going, huh, that's strange. But I could hear Vanessa like she was taking care of business. And I was like, what the fuck is Psy doing? And I walked in around the corner and I shit you not, he was doing a headstand.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I love this
man.
Amazing. Like he was listening. He was taking it all in, but he was also going to do a headstand. And that's what I think of Sidewind Stanley.
So on brand for Sidewind Stanley. That's amazing.
I feel like this whole podcast is just how much we love Psy now.
Yes, it totally is. Totally is. We have to cut together this specific part where we're talking
just for
about
him. Yeah. that was your first kind of tiptoe into a full band experience. Tell me about Nashville. Tell me about your relationship with Nashville and how you made your way there and
how it feels now because you're not there full time. And sometimes I know that's a scary thing, or sometimes I know it's a good thing. So tell me about your relationship with Nashville.
I feel really lucky because I have an amazing community in Nashville, and I've had to work to stay – to keep this feeling of connection at times. Like because I live – for those who are just listening and don't know, I live in southern Colorado. I live in a small town in the mountains, and it's beautiful here, and there is like very little connection back to – Nashville that's here for me. There's an amazing community of musicians who live here and music lovers and cool venues. And I don't think of this as a place where I have any connection to the industry, which I love. And it's just this community that keeps me, this community and this place, it just reminds me of like how I actually want to live my life, the kind of community I want to build, like the kind of life I want to live. The kind of like down to earth people I want to spend time with. It's not that that doesn't exist in Nashville. It exists in spades. I first went to Nashville in 2018 really my first real time going to Nashville was in 2018 for Americana Fest. And I didn't know, I knew very few people. I knew Robbie Hecht. He was one of my good friends, and I knew very few other people, and I had kind of a magical night where my now manager, Blair Clark, walked into my showcase at the Station Inn with Ron Pope, her husband, and they run Brooklyn Basement Records, and it was completely fate. Like, they had a list of places they were thinking about going, and then they tried to get into a dinner spot nearby, and they couldn't get in. And they got a later reservation and they walked into my showcase like to pass the time. I think that's right. I'll have to ask Blair, but it was like they had a bunch of different places they were going to go. And it was like really by chance, like it had to do with the time they were trying to eat dinner. And they walked in and Blair handed me her card at the end of the night. And that started a beautiful working relationship that we have to this day. I can't, like, that sounds like weird music industry mythology when you're like, somebody just walked into the room and my fate changed. And it did. It did. Like, Blair and I and Ron started working together. I ended up hiring them for label services to help me release Traveling Mercies, which was my first full-length album. They worked their asses off for me.
Yeah.
They were incredible. And they started to connect me into this Nashville community that they were also building because they were still kind of new in town at the time. This was fall of 2018. They just moved from Brooklyn. So they also had a sense of like, where like they had a sense of being outsiders a little bit, right? Because Ron had come from more of like the indie pop world. And so together, it felt like we started to build something and to build some incredible community. And now I can't even go to now I get anxious when I go to Nashville because I'm like, oh God, I want to see everybody. And I can only see like 1/10 of the people I want to see. And so I try to like divvy it up. But long story short, the way I stay feeling connected to Nashville, my whole team is there. My label is there. I'm signed to Oh Boy Records, John Prine's label. They're all there. My management team is there and so many friends. And my goal generally is to get there once, like at least 3 times a year.
Yeah.
And I'm on track to do that this year. And I realize that my feelings of being kind of out in the wind and far away could actually be alleviated not by moving to Nashville, but by going there more often and just building a little more community and staying connected to my people there. And then I get to still live here, which is wonderful. I'm kind of allergic to every single pollen in Nashville.
It is like, wild there.
It's
the pollens
wild.
There are otherworldly. They are otherworldly.
Like, they're so bad. And like, I have to tell you, I'm like a sickly little allergy girl, and I'm working on this with my allergist. I'm in immunotherapy, but I am not physically very well when I go to Nashville for like wide swaths of the year. Like I kind of have to time it. Yeah. I timed it badly this time and I was so sick. Like I was so exhausted and allergy ridden. So when it comes to like weather, politics, and infrastructure, mm-hmm. Nashville's like a nightmare for me. And like it's legitimately kind of a nightmare for a lot of my friends. Like
it is such a nightmare for those things. It sucks.
Like the infrastructure there is not, it's crumbling. Like public safety is a massive issue. Like school mm-hmm. shootings, like there's mm-hmm. so much. And I don't mean to sound like fear-mongering, like country mouse when I say all this, but legitimately Nashville has grown so much and the city has not had the capacity to manage that growth. And what it has done is it is like, it's like displaced tons mm-hmm. of people. Mm-hmm. It's like gentrified historically Black neighborhoods. It's displaced artists and musicians and writers. It's carved out like historic parts of Nashville. And, and as far as I can tell, they don't seem to be interested in like expanding any highways. And so you could drive across Nashville at 1 p.m. on a Sunday and be in a 40-minute traffic jam. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Nashville's growth, even in the last 4 years since I've been going there more and more often, is, like you said, it's something that is almost unbelievable from a growth perspective, especially when you think about the politics and the other things that are going on there. But I guess there's a whole lot to say, which I'm not going to say, because totally. I'm kind of with you too. And I don't even think it's rose-colored glasses. Every time I go back to Nashville, I'm reminded that for a hot second, I was an outsider and one person said, come with me. And then another person said, oh, you're with them? Why don't you come with me to this thing? And then it became, oh, there's three of us. Oh, there's 10 of us. Oh, shit. I have a full community of friends and people I love and would do anything for. So for me, Nashville is more heart than head. Totally. But I'm like you. Like, I don't need to be there all of the time to feel like I'm there all of the time, if that makes sense.
Completely. Completely. I it's like it's a wonderful place for me to go and spend time. And the community there is probably the best community I know. Yeah. Like all my friends and like all the amazing like queer artists, all my friends who are like Black country artists, Black Opry, like everything that I care about is happening in Nashville. And I also like, I live in a state like Colorado is a fantastic state for healthcare, women's like reproductive rights and taxes. Like I lived in Tennessee three big for
things.
A little while.
Three big things.
Three massive things. Three things that like
our bodies,
really affect
our
you.
Bodies and our taxes.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. It's crazy because I lived in Tennessee. I did live in Tennessee for a while from 2014 to 2016. My ex-husband and I lived in Chattanooga. And so I got a sense of what it was like to live in Tennessee. And I worked part-time in a hospital as a Spanish interpreter. I got a whole gigantic cross-section of like everybody who lives in Tennessee. Like and what I saw was a state with extreme poverty, massive wealth gap, massive sort of access to healthcare gap, and a super regressive tax structure. The fact is like Tennessee doesn't have income tax. That's right. They just have sales tax.
Yeah.
That is the most like anti-working class thing that you could ever have in a state.
Hence the lack of infrastructure, right? Because how do you pay for it?
Completely. Yeah. Completely. And like, I want Nashville to get better. And many of my friends are fighting for that state to get better. And it's not my state to fight for. But I love visiting it. And I love my friends there. and it's not my home. And maybe one day I would love to go and spend like I have an idea that in my mind, like, there will come a time where it's like, oh, I go to Nashville every October, like when it's nice, you know? And although October's nice everywhere, it's really hard to figure out where to spend October. Because then when I'm home, it's amazing.
That sounds like a great book title. And each chapter could be a different place over the Octobers of your life.
It is literally the most like first world touring musician problem to be like, where should I spend October? Should I tour the Northeast? Should I go to the South? Should I tour the Rocky Mountain region? Like the West Coast is nice. Like everything is nice in October. But anyways, I really ranted on about Tennessee. but now like in the States, right, with everything that has happened politically in the past, I don't know. It goes back more than Trump, right? But let's say
Yeah.
12 years, 12 to 16 years, states have become really, it's become a really different experience to live in different states.
Yes.
Because of taxes, healthcare, infrastructure. And I feel really lucky to live in Colorado.
Yeah. I mean, coming back after 20 years away, this is definitely not the place that I left 20 years ago. It's very, very different. And although this is the country that raised me and California is the state that – California, Missouri are the states that raised me.
Missouri.
Yeah. I do not feel at home here right now. Yeah. And I'm not sure if that feeling will return. I'm going to give it a little bit of time. But it is – it's a completely different beast now. Filled with great people and great opportunity, but after living abroad in place where we had like healthcare, where we had time off from work that was paid, where we had food that was readily available, that was healthy and nutritious, it's just it's a different way of seeing the United States. Once you've been on the outside and you've come back in, you are that insider outsider, and it's a lot easier to go, actually, maybe we're not the best at everything or even a lot of things, and we could fix this.
But we all have to want to. This country is like pretty fucked. And like, and to go to like, when I tour over in Europe, Europe, smaller, slightly more homogenous countries. Okay. But that said, I spent a lot of time in places where universal healthcare is not a controversial thing.
No, like, shouldn't be.
We've crunched the numbers. Universal healthcare would be cheaper than what we're all doing right now. Touring over in Europe has really actually shown me how desperate things have gotten here in our home country. How desperately bad, how many holes there are in our social safety net, how much it's being ripped apart. And that people are being increasingly sort of radicalized and separated by political narratives that are really fear driven.
Advertising dollars, like actually driven by advertising dollars.
People are making money off of our anger and our fear and our outrage and the ways in which we other people. And so I really feel that one of the opportunities I get to have as a storyteller and as a songwriter is to build some bridges between people and to tell stories that are human stories. And to like speak out about things that are important. And also I'm like kind of specific when I'm writing songs that are like, I don't write overtly political songs.
Yeah.
Mostly because I feel like I'm preaching to the choir if I do that. And I've never really liked overtly political art. I think storytelling is political in and of itself. I'm a history major. The stories that get told are – oh my God, really? Oh, yes, yay.
This makes
total sense. I was literally about to say this makes sense right when you said that. This makes sense. So you know that the stories that get told are an indication of power structures and politics. So to me, one of the most political acts we can do is shine light on stories of people to like bring back a radical sense of shared humanity. Like, that's a powerful thing that we can do. And it's very tempting to devolve into like yelling at each other across the internet. And that is literally serving nobody except for Meta and TikTok. That's and right. Why give them more money? Why give them more of your time and your attention, your brain energy?
Our data, everything.
Oh God, everything. Burn it to the ground. The older I get, the more radicalized I get.
Isn't it funny that we think it's radical to want a world in which hopefulness, connection, and shared responsibility towards a better tomorrow is like activist and radical?
Yeah. Yeah, and that it's radical to divest from massive corporations that are working against those outcomes.
Yeah, and I mean, if
like,
we go
– like, that's radical. It's countercultural.
Yeah.
But it's actually
– existing feels radical. Countercultural, right? Existing
– right.
If we think back to the linoleum floor earlier and sharing a picture of myself on the internet in my undies crying – like
it's a great photo. It's beautiful.
Thank you. My life, your life, nobody's life should have to be should have to feel like breathing activism, but that's how it feels right now, just to be a human who feels shit.
Yeah.
So we have talked each other's ears off for an hour, and we've talked to our audience for an hour. Oh, I want to know.
I lost you for a second. Like, was that
what
me?
Is your linoleum floor? And what is the thing
you
that's
are.
Going to?
What Sorry.
Is the linoleum floor that's going to catch you in the next
I
year?
I think that my internet has cut out for a second. Will you repeat that question once I get you back? There you are. There you are. Okay.
What is your, as we move forward, what is your proverbial linoleum floor as you move forward? What's the thing that that catches you and helps you through the ups and downs, the tides where your ebb and flow meet?
I think for me, it's a couple things. I'm the most important one really is like my partner and my friends. Like my partner and my friends, I can take my deep artistic insecurities and frustrations and career frustrations to my partner, and he is also an artist and a theater director, and he's worked in nonprofits. And so he's also worked in these worlds, right? Where like, you know, you come up against, anyways, everything. You come up against everything. And he always gives me the space to feel what I'm feeling and then encourages me and and reminds me that what I'm feeling is normal. You know, that those ups and downs. And also my dear friends, mostly really truly like my women friends who are also musicians. It's like there's such power in community. And so I have these friends who I can be vulnerable with about the fact that I know on the outside it looks like I'm doing all these things, and underneath the surface I'm fighting serious ambivalence about my participation in social media. I'm struggling to finish new songs. I'm sad and hopeful all at once. And I, you know, I talk to my friends about, you know, our bodies and our history of eating disorders and like relationships to ourselves. And that's like, that's my linoleum floor, you know?
Oh.
And I feel so lucky to have that. My other linoleum floor is my antidepressant. So that's great.
Yes. I mean, always helpful.
I mean, seriously, it's crazy because my depression got... I've had clinical depression for a long time, but it worsened during the pandemic and my divorce. And like, I just getting on like a daily medication has really neutralized isn't the right word. It's softened the lows, and it's helped me create. It's helped me access and use the tools that I learned in therapy. Of it's like made this little voice in my head louder, the voice that says, hey, it's okay to have a down day. That's totally normal. Like, yeah. You don't have to feel amazing every day. Like, no. You don't have to feel productive every day. Wow. You know, like, honestly, the voice that you write in, like, in your Substack, like, reminds me of that voice. It's that voice that gives me permission to feel all the things at once, or to be sad, yes. or to feel overwhelmed, and yes. to know that, like, those feelings aren't forever, and it's okay to rest. It's like the part of me that has learned to be gentler with myself was yes. able to be louder now that I'm on a medication. Mm. Yeah. And it's been really life-changing for me.
I love that.
It's kind
of, that gentility yeah. is so important. The gentle nature of who we are, I think, especially here in America, we're taught that, like, we have to be strong, stiff upper lip, recklessly individualistic. We are very loud overseas. American travelers are like, ooh, sometimes.
Yeah.
I know that was a blanket statement, but wow, we are loud talkers. But the permission to be gentle is a beautiful way to put that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in a world that's in an economy that's trying to exact everything from us.
Mm-hmm.
there's an amazing activist. And I feel bad. I'm in a brain fog right now because of my allergy meds. But she started the NAP ministry. It's Rest as Resistance. And actually, her name is founder. I've like trying to find the founder. She's incredible. I've listened to Trisha Hersey. I listened to an amazing interview with her. And a big part of this is particularly about the ways in which this economy has exacted everything and relied on the labor of Black women and historically and still. And she talks about rest as resistance. And I don't I'm not trying to pull this teaching out of its context for Black women, because it is absolutely for them. But it was such an instructive and beautiful thing to read more about her work and about choosing, like, the activism of rest, the radical activism of rest and nourishing oneself, and how we've also been sold on this idea of self-care as like essential oils and bath bombs and mani-pedis. The idea that, like, self-care costs money. And and she kind of rips that apart, which is amazing because somebody needed to. And the NAP ministry, you guys should check it out.
I will find it and put links to it in the in the show notes. Can I do a quick roundup round with you? A quick fire round?
Yes.
Emily Scott Robinson, what is one thing you cannot live without?
Coffee. Espresso specifically.
We are twins.
Yeah.
What's one thing on your bucket list?
Buy a house.
Oh, I love that. Yes. Yeah. I love that. Sunrise or sunset?
Sunset.
Sweet or savory?
Savory.
Oh, yeah. All right. Instead of what's one thing you would tell your 14-year-old self, what is one thing your 14-year-old self would tell you right now?
That she's so excited and kind of mystified that I get to do this as a career.
I love that.
She's like, what?
Isn't it amazing? Really? Like, if you think about that 14-year-old kid inside of you, she'd be like, you're making music. You're doing these things.
Yeah. She'd be like, you've written songs? You have like 4 albums?
That's amazing. Wow. Well done, my friend. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh my gosh, Cassie, this was such a joy. I love you so much. I love everything that you do. And I can't wait to finally see you again.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. I could talk to you for hours. I love you so much.
Mwah. I love you too.
I don't want to die.
The Kindness Warriors podcast is hosted, produced, recorded, edited, and brought to you by me, Cassie Roma. And what a pleasure it is to bring all of these beautiful stories into the world. As always, thank you for your time, for your polite and kind and engaged feedback, and for simply being a part of the Kindness Warriors community. I appreciate you. Skinny dip in the ocean, look, I don't give a rip. Smoke something stronger than a marble cigarette. Oh. I want to just sip every whiskey, take one too many shots. Pass on the pricey with the money I ain't got. All the things that I ain't conquered yet. I wanna live a life I regret. Stop and breathe. Take a look at what I'd see. I was spinning my wheels as the world kept spinning round. Just taking it day by day, getting by and away. Never making that leap with both feet on the ground. I want to get married in Vegas to a stranger on the strip, skinny dipping in the ocean. Look, something stronger than a marble cigarette. Oh. I want to just sip every whiskey, take one too many shots. Pass on the pricey with the money I ain't got. All the things that I ain't conquered yet. I wanna live a life I regret. Just taste fiery whiskey, baby.